My name is Darren Hupke, and this is Pixels and Polygons. Welcome to a new episode. Pixels and Polygons is here for another week of action, of intrigue, of drama. I have a first-time guest on the show today, so this is exciting to have a new voice. We'll let them introduce themselves after the opening segment here, after the intro, and once the episode gets rolling. So be excited for that. Same business up front, patreon.com/Darren Hupke for original writing content and digital storefront, pixelsandpolygons.net to directly purchase my books, the 32-bit library series of books, and retro game zine. There is still hours left at the time of this episode posts of the Kickstarter for Retro Game Zine issue 3 and 4, and I'm going to be reprinting 1 and 2. So if you wanted to jump on board with that train, you can get all the issues if you want, or pick and choose exactly which ones you do want. Issue 3 and 4 has some guest contributors, so it's like really like a magazine now because there's multiple people involved, which is really rad. Bucket list things. I've got a you can check out the Kickstarter page, but just cool folks contributing that makes sense for the games that we're covering, and it's been a lot of fun to do that project too. So check those things out. You can find me on Blue Sky as at darrenhupke.bsky.social. It's the only social media I am on. And then I also have a at pixelsandpolygons.net handle for Pixels and Polygons directly for social media contact purposes. But that's it. That's the only places you'll find me on the internet for the time being. And yeah, I think I just made a short and sweet version of this business upfront stuff. So that's cool. That's all I got. I have been in the trenches doing the research phase for the 32-bit library greatest hits edition. So 50 games covered that were re-released during the during the PlayStation generation, but re-released with that like neon green and red greatest hits branding. So this will be a fun volume of the book that will not be a specific publisher focused, but focused on that greatest hits branding. So it gives me a chance to cover some games that likely would never have gotten covered because either the publisher themselves doesn't have very large of a catalog, or the publisher themselves doesn't have a very good catalog, and it wouldn't make sense to an entire book to cover all their games. So I have a list up that you can see on my Patreon. There's a post there that lists the 50 games that will be included in that, and otherwise, yeah, that's it. Still figuring out what to do next with the Beat 'Em Up Volume 1. Still a bit of a bummer having a completed book here and not being able to produce that, but I think I will be able to soon. I just have to, you know, cross some T's, dot some I's, and talk to some folks to make sure. Otherwise, that's what I got for you. This week's episode is a fun question, so it's the evergreen question again, which is a great time to meet somebody new as well anyway. So what is an average game or a game that doesn't get enough attention that you love, and why? So we answer that question and have a fun conversation dialogue around all that. So enjoy the episode, enjoy the new guest, and we will have them on future episodes for sure. We will kind of wrap this here then, and I'll leave it to it and catch you all next week. Bye. All right. Well, welcome to another episode of Pixels and Polygons. And I've got a first-time guest on the show. I was jokingly just sharing with him previously to this. I have to thank the Flashback 64 crew. getting into their orbits, being able to be on their show, and then in like Discord chats and things with some folks that were guests of theirs have really helped me get a lot of guests on my show. And so secretly, this is, you know, big shout outs to Goo and McKenna over at Flashback. But I have a new guest in Nick McConnell. So Nick, tell us a little about yourself and who you are, and welcome to the show.
Hey, Darren, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on. Yes, and thanks, of course, to the Flashback 64 crew. That being in that orbit has been pretty neat. It's a good crew. And I'm grateful to be on this show, really, as a result. So thanks for having me. I'm Nick. How do I introduce myself? I work at Riot. I'm not here on official business, very clearly, but I work at Riot and I focus on age ratings, compliance for our games globally. And when I'm not doing that, I host a weekly stream called Instruction Derby, where I take a look at old video game manuals, old or new, actually. If there are new ones, I'll read them. Video game manuals that lost art, and dig on through and just enjoy those. So that's the other thing that I do. And that's me.
Yeah, that's fun. It's a little power hour each week. I've joined a bunch of them. They're just kind of fun to participate in and see some of the dialogue. It is such a cool job to have, like, that clearly isn't around anymore, but to write like that creative text and write like that copy for some of those manuals. Like, some of them have like storytelling within and like position and set up the story and characters and things like that in like a really fun way that you don't necessarily see in game in some of these classic games at all. So I think there is a cool art to that. And I think if I was, you know, an older version of me, if I was born a decade or two sooner, like, that would have been a job I definitely would have like wanted to do at a game company for sure.
Oh, 100%. It would have been so cool. Some of the freedom that I feel like they had, especially back in the older days, let's go with the Nintendo, Sega Genesis era, like, there was a lot of freedom to expand greatly on what the game's story was telling. Some of these things are amazing. The Plock manual, just as a quick aside, the manual for Plock on the Super Nintendo is a really great one, where the Pickford brothers, who developed the game, developed the manual in secret so that the publisher wouldn't get their hands on it and make the manual themselves. They wanted a nice manual. They wanted it to really represent the game with their voice. And they felt that the publisher wouldn't probably do that appropriately. So they just went ahead and secretly built out this entire manual. And if you get your hands on it, it's gorgeous. It's massive. And they just wrote it all themselves, sent it over to the publisher, finished. And that was their gambit to be able to tell their story properly within the Plock manual, which I think is a pretty cool move.
Yeah, that's pretty rad. Yeah. So do you have a favorite manual you've covered so far then on the show?
Oh, you know,
or
what
one that stands out?
You know, so many of them are great in so many different ways. I would say I have two that really stand out to me. I wouldn't say that the best, quote unquote, I'm doing hand quotes. I wouldn't say that they're the best necessarily, but I really enjoy Magic Johnson's Basketball on the Amiga, because it's about 5 pages of small font just listing his achievements. It basically reads like somebody who's like a super sports fan, like Magic Johnson's biggest fan, on a major bender, just listing out all of his achievements from high school through college through the NBA. I enjoy that one a lot. And I enjoy the manual for Zombie U on the Wii U. Zombie U manual on the Wii U comes from an era of manuals where they were already sort of starting to dip out, getting thinner, not as much love being put into the story sides. And this thing has so much character and personality behind it that it really stands out for me as like a late era special manual. So yeah, Zombie U and Magic Johnson's Basketball on the Amiga.
Zombie U, that always that was an alarm for me in concern that you know, we had Super Mario 64, Mario Kart 64, like everything was 64, you know, just like there was, everything was super on the SNES or the SNES, as we all call it. I was worried that the Wii U would suddenly be branded with like a lot of like whatever U, like Zombie U, and like that would be a trend or something like that. You know, and luckily it didn't, because that it's just like a really strange one, you know. But it's such a big thing that Nintendo consoles were doing, even handhelds. Like the DS had a lot of DS, you know, monikered ones.
Yep, or new Super Mario DS, right? You would have been like, having a U at the end of everything would have been truly abhorrent. There's a part of me that would have loved to have seen Super Mario U. I think that would have been pretty cool. But that would have been pretty yucky to look at on all of those games, you're right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah, welcome to the show then. I sent you the questions. So the main episode question you've known in advance. So we'll talk about things that you have kind of thought about already. But for the icebreakers, these are ones you don't know in advance. So things I want to, you know, maybe catch a I don't know why I find enjoying it, but like making somebody like struggle to think of an answer. Like it is just a good time.
Let's
for
do
me.
It. let's do it.
Let's see. I guess we'll do like not one that's too difficult or anything for you. Like, yeah, this is a strange one, but I do like to ask it. But what is an option or a setting that you always change before starting a game?
Ooh, an option that I always change. You know, this might sound pretty boring, but I'm gonna go with lighting. You know, I know that in a lot of games now you're sort of prompted to adjust the lighting at the beginning, the brightness. I like my games bright. I don't really care if they're super washed out looking. I just like it when they're bright. My living room has a big window in it, so the room gets bright, and so it can get dark on the screen. So I will always go in and adjust the brightness to make it probably a bit brighter than the developers intended. So apologies, developers. But brightness, I think, definitely in the older days, it's not necessarily a setting that I would change per se, but a settings menu thing I would always go check out were the music and sound examples. Like you go to the BGM and all that kind of stuff, and you can go and listen to all the music. Mm-hmm. That's what I used to do all the time. Bring that back. That's what I want.
That is cool. And I had a really, I want to say short-lived, but I don't know if you can even say it lived at all, but a band, my best friend and I, we used a drum machine. I played guitar. It was really noisy and obnoxious and everything. All of our songs are about video games. And so like, I would like take some of the older games and like that had like those sound test options and like rip some of those sound effects to be able to use like some of the voice clips and all stuff in the songs and everything. So like now on the internet, I can just like rip like a YouTube video or find something like that to get those sounds and everything. But like having like Final Fight and be able to go through and listen to all the grunts and groans and impact sounds and everything for no reason. It was cool there as like a resource to like rip and pull from and everything too. So
it's kind of rad. I'd be curious. Oh, I was going to say, I'd be curious what the original reasoning for that. I'm sure the answer is very obvious, but I'd be curious what the reasoning was for having all of that in the settings menu in games that were sold, you know, to consumers back in the day. I don't know if it's a testing thing or what. I'd be curious to find out the answer to that. It's for another day.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder why. It's maybe one of those things because they could, like all the sounds like were like in the way the development was. It was like simple for them to be able to do that and play that back, you know. But yeah, I mean, I like that it was there and everything. So that's kind of cool. One thing I'll always do, I did like some school on like audio production stuff. Like a dream job was always to work like in audio and sound design for like games and stuff. But one of the options I'll always do is turn down the music volume in games. I'll bump it down like one or two points. Like if it's a 10-point slider, I'll make sure music's at an 8 and everything else at a 10. Like I want to make sure I'm hearing like the crunch or the voices or whatever it may be. But I always sacrifice the audio just a little bit from like a musical standpoint. And it is an odd thing for me to do, especially with my interest in everything, but I always feel guilty doing that. I also invert my aim. I am a flight stick style, you know. I need that inverted aim when some people think I'm a weirdo for doing that, but I can't not do it at all, so I have to invert that y-axis.
Were you a PC gamer growing up?
No.
Wow, okay, all right.
Always been a console gamer. Always been I see the joystick and I see like when I'm tilting it down, I'm thinking of it passing through and on the other side going up. Like it makes sense to me. Like I can just see that like movement, you know, and like not just pressing it down and having it go down. Like logically, you know, other people see it as like to me, it's wired differently.
I had a friend describe it to me who also inverts, who had described it to me as though you've got like a stick on the back of your head Right. And so it's like you pull it down to look up, you push it in like that. So it was like that made it make a lot of logical sense to me. And for a brief period of time, I was like, no, he's right. I'm going to do it this way because that makes a lot of sense. And I was just so bad at it. I went back. I was like, OK, it may not make sense to do it the way that I'm doing it, but I'm back.
You obviously got to do whatever is comfortable. Like, I mean, so if you're used to it, like, cool. Like, go with what you're used to. But, like, yeah, I've unfortunately, like, passing the controller around and trying to play games with friends growing up, it was always like, hold on, pause, go invert my control, just because I'd start to play and I'd have, like, I wouldn't be as skilled because I would have to, like, struggle to try and, like, learn how to, like, aim and shoot and all that stuff with that. So, okay. Cool. Well, then that's the icebreaker. I want to throw a this or that at you. This is something newer that I'm doing. But let's ask this or that. Would you rather choose between, a day one edition or a director's cut game of the year edition? What type of person are you there?
I guess, that's a great question. So I guess the core of it is, when am I jumping into a game? This one is stumping me. Hold on, I got to have a second here. You know, I think that all things being equal, let's say that I don't have as many time restrictions. I have two answers. Sorry, this is what I'll do. I'm going to back up. I have two answers, and the answer is ultimately going to be both, which is deeply unsatisfying. But here's my thought. My predilection would be to my preference, I think, would be generally to go with the day one, because it's exciting. New game, you know, what's going on? I want to be there day one. I want to do all that sort of stuff. However, with kids, with work, with everything going on, it is so rarely the case that I can actually dive all the way into a brand new game. So I wind up deciding often that I need to wait until way later, until I know I have time to get into something that I'm really excited about, especially if it's a bigger thing. So in my heart, in my heart, I'm day one. In my mind, I'm director's cut. Is that what is that? Day one in the streets, director's cut in the sheets. I don't know.
Yep, that's okay. That's the answer. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm the exact same way. I used to work at a game store, and I would buy every game. Like day one, I'd have it all. Mm-hmm. Like always, day one, and then after work, my wife and I, we'd go to Target or something like that, and you know, a new movie that's out, like, oh, let's buy it, put it on the shelf, and everything. And then I was buying comics, and so you know, like, I wasn't waiting for it to be collected. I was buying monthly issues. Like, this looks good, I'll catch up and read this eventually, but I'm still gonna buy it right now. And eventually, I started looking around and realizing all of that was like money on the table, like. Some of the movies, like half the movies on our shelf were still sealed. You know, half the games were unplayed because I never got around to them. And so now, like, I only buy a game when I know I'm ready to play it. And it doesn't mean I don't love it. It doesn't mean I'm not supporting it. Like, if I'm not ready for it, I'm not ready for it.
That's smart. The policy that I've done, because you're right, it's money on the table. And yeah, you're like me, I think, in that regard, where I'll be like, well, I like that, or this seems like a decent price, you know, that kind of thing. I'll just get it. And then the backlog gets crazy and you never touch any of it. I've lost my train of thought. Bear with me for a second here. Holy moly, what was I going to say? Oh, the rule that I have placed upon myself is that, and I try to, generally speaking, I won't buy another game until the game that I am currently playing, I have either finished or decided that I'm not going to continue on with. So what I used to do, so I did the same thing, like, new game comes out, I'm going to buy it, I'll play it for a little bit, and then another new game comes out, and I'm going to buy that one, and maybe I'll play that. And that got messy. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to play this game, and once I'm done with it, I can move on to the next thing. And that has also, I think, saved me quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
Steam sales don't count in this one, in fairness.
Yeah, that's exactly how I do it, too. Like, I don't necessarily have to roll credits on it, but if I know I'm finished with it, like, I experienced it and got what I wanted out of it, or what I was expecting to get out of it, or needed to get out of it, or whatever it may be, like, I can move on for it and know that. But what's funny is that you think I would impulsively, like, stop playing it and buy something new and everything, but I've probably, like, rolled the credits and seen more games' endings, like, now doing it this way than I ever did in my life and everything. So it's been a secret benefit, too. Like, I'm getting more out of the games I am buying, and I'm buying less. So I'm like winning on both ends. So
it sort of forces a commitment, right? Like you're like, well, I got to at least give this thing a shot. And then you stick through and maybe you stick through a slower early patch, right? Or a sequence in the middle that you're doing a lot of backtracking. You know, you sort of push through, and sometimes that can be fantastic. Sometimes your favorite games are like that, right? You just needed to. I was like that with Control. I had a real rough start with Control, and I didn't particularly enjoy myself. But I bought it, right? So I was like, well, I gotta keep going. I spent $60 on this thing, and it's one of my all time favorites. I just needed to get over that early hump. So, benefits. Yeah.
Remedy is probably my favorite developer whose games so I just never played. I loved Max Payne. Like, I guess I mainly played Max Payne on like the PlayStation 2 version of it and everything. But I loved Max Payne. Alan Wake came out, and there was some kind of collector's edition I did buy for that. But like, I only played it for maybe 3 or 4 hours, and then something new and fancy came out. I never went back to it or anything. I didn't get an Xbox One, so like the Quantum Break thing, even though it sounded rad, like on paper and plan, like I was like, oh, this could be a TV show and there's gonna be a game that plays it. This is so rad. And then they didn't get to completely do everything they wanted to do with it. But either way, like I was like, that seems like neat. I want to try that out, and just never really got a hands on it. Control, I think just wrong place, wrong time. I think that's when I started to kind of like play the games I am doing now. So I just never got around to it. And then now like Alan Wake 2 looks fantastic, but there's like this creepy edge to it that like I now can't play scary games too as an adult. And so I'm like, man, I want to play all of these. They all look like they're super fun. And now knowing there's like this connective universe in a way, like they've done creatively, like I love the idea that these games are existing with each other, and I want to experience them, but like I've just, time and place has never let me actually get behind any of them besides the original Max Payne.
You know, but that's right. I have played Alan Wake 2, and it is very scary. I bumped it down to easy. Actually, that's what I'll do. If I can go back to the question about what I do in the menus for video games, if I go into a horror game or a horror adjacent game or something creepy, I'm bumping that difficulty all the way down every time. I don't want to deal with the having to actually be good at it too.
I've not been able to play a lot of horror games in like the last 5+ years or longer, really.
Same.
Because there's like, it's this anxiety that is not balanced with entertainment like it used to. Like I beat Dead Space 1 with just the plasma cutter, like made the challenge for myself just to have a good time like with that. And I could do that no problem. But like, it started creeping up on me, and now like playing like Resident Evil 7, I realized like, oh no, I just can't personally play this game. Like I'm too, like the anxiety is too high. But I think lowering the difficulty and knowing like, hey, you know what, make it easy on yourself, like experience this and have some fun with it still and not stress about it, because that's I don't need that.
Absolutely.
That's something I can maybe try and do. Maybe that's how I'm able to experience Alan Wake 2 finally.
Give it a shot. Alan Wake 2 is incredible. That the lower difficulty, it's also manageable.
Cool. Okay. Well, all right. Well, we're cruising on through it. Let's get to the question of the moment then.
Cool.
This one we've asked, like, I think literally every guest has at some point been able to answer this question as well. This is one, like, I wouldn't care if eventually, like, I run out of questions and it's just answering this question every week. But what is a personal favorite game or like an average game that you love that doesn't get enough attention? It's just kind of that chance to showcase and highlight something weird or fun or cool from your backlog and from your gaming past that, could deserve some attention and some love. So yeah, what is that game for you that you want to share?
Heck yeah. I love that everybody wants to answer this one. Actually, I think that's great. There's so many games from every era that are interesting and quirky or good, but they're maybe missing something, or they have some rough edges, or they're just straight up good and that other folks didn't glom onto for one reason or another. And I find that oftentimes those are my absolute favorites. I just think that they're oftentimes the most interesting. Maybe there's a little less polish or, you know, like something like that. So there's a lot. And then when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking a lot about, what kinds of games would I want to talk about for this? And I landed, and I just kept coming back to, there were like a lot of PlayStation 2 action games, basically. It was just like a ton of PlayStation 2 action games. Like the Shinobi, that kind of thing. But I'm going to go with Gotham City Imposters, the first-person shooter, multiplayer shooter that was around during the Xbox 360 PS3 day, where you take sides as either a Batman imposter or a Joker imposter, run around different maps based on Gotham City, and use pretty interesting mechanics to navigate the space, flying, bouncing high off of trampolines, all that. At its core, it's a fairly straightforward, you know, first-person shooter multiplayer game, but it just has so much character and so much crunch to it that I absolutely adored it. It felt and looked and sounded to me like no other game that I was playing at the time. And I wound up putting in, God, I mean, how many tens or hundreds of hours. So that for me is the game. It's gone now, right? I don't believe that it's playable anywhere. It's a, you know, certainly the servers are offline. I don't know if it was ever particularly successful, but I don't hear folks talk about it. Although whenever it's mentioned, you start to see people coming out of the woodwork. So, you know, there are dozens of us.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, I remember the game existing. I never tried it or played it. And I have, like, no, like, orbit around this game at all. Like, I couldn't even picture, like, its cover art or whatever. It was a download, wasn't it? Like, a digital
game. It was a download.
So I guess it wouldn't necessarily have had something that was staring at me on a shelf. But, yeah, I don't remember this at all. But, yeah, I've never been, like, a big DC guy.
Me neither.
I was always like a Marvel and like now like independent like stuff pretty much. But yeah, interesting. I'm looking it up. Monolith Productions was a developer who I guess Fear, Condemned, The Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War game.
Yep.
Huh.
That's a pretty good lineup. Pretty good lineup of games.
Yeah, Fear and Condemned being those like 360 era like games. I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense why they would do a first person style game like that as well. Interesting. But it was online only. Like you just kind of persistently play just in like a.
Yes, it was. I want to say it was like one of those, like, do you remember that era when there was that era, the PS3, Xbox 360 era, where there was sort of a delineation between the full priced box games in the lower price download? Like that was sort of the distinction, the delineation. This was one of those that I want to say was like $15, you know, it was, around there. And it wasn't, I don't recall it being especially, what would the buzzword be, like feature rich, I guess. It was just at its core, a really solid, game with interesting characters, and I love the movement in it. It's a game. So for me, one of the things, if I step back, one of the things that I really love in a video game is I love just navigating the environments, right? Like this is the Mario thing for me. Mario to me is fun because by and large, it's always fun to move Mario around, right? Mm-hmm. You get the momentum, you get the jumps, you know, all that kind of stuff. It just feels good. This is one of those games that to me always just felt really good. There's a lot of verticality, but it's not just, you know, oh, you walk up a staircase and now you're up higher than the other guys and you can shoot down. It's, oh, there's a trampoline over here. And if I jump, if I move and step on this trampoline, I'll shoot up like 30 feet. And then I can use a wingsuit because I've attached a wingsuit to my character to fly around the level, drop in behind somebody. There are just so many ways of approaching the levels, and they were built with just enough space and again, verticality, that you could find yourself in interesting scenarios, but the levels were never too big, that you would find yourself in a quiet space for very long. It's just, I felt like it was just a masterful game. So maybe it's not an average game, but it's a game that nobody really talks about that I sank so much time into.
That's the spirit of the question. I mean, it's, you know, a game that you love or doesn't get enough attention, or an average game that doesn't get enough attention. I mean, yeah, we don't want to come in here and talk about Chrono Trigger or anything. Like, you know, like that gets its praise enough, you know, and for good reason. Obviously, people should spend time talking about that. But this question helps us highlight a game that, you know, does not get that same time in the spotlight. But yeah, interesting. I should look at some video of it to kind of like refresh myself on that and everything. There were so many games. I mean, even the AAA games of that era, like you couldn't buy Uncharted 2 without the online multiplayer component added. You know, like I think didn't BioShock 2 have like a forced multiplayer mode too, or maybe they fought against it or something? Yeah, like,
no, they did.
Yeah, and it's they weren't necessarily always good, but like. That idea, because the 360 was just hitting what it was hitting, and PS3, you know, that connectivity and that online play was just something that, like, it was an expectation, you know, so like they needed games that sold that experience for sure.
I've got a the kind of, I was about to call it the high watermark of that, but maybe the maybe it's more of a trough of that, was that, so I worked briefly at 2K in QA. On Spec Ops The Line. It was very brief, you know, contract thing. I had been working at Pandemic Studios. We had just wrapped Saboteur and we got shut down by EA. I needed a job. So I went to QA over at 2K and I was put on Spec Ops The Line. And have you played Spec Ops The Line?
I played the original $10 Spec Ops on the PlayStation game with the very first launch budget title that was, and never touched the series after that.
Spec Ops The Line is, as I understand it, I actually haven't played those. Spec Ops The Line is a very different beast, and it starts out being a very kind of straightforward military guy in the Middle East, you know, kind of stuff, I guess, junk. You know, that's the sense that you're going to get from it when you first start. But as the game progresses, it takes you down this story path that really calls into question. It sounds kind of silly now in 2025 saying it, but at the time it was pretty remarkable. It questions the, you know, player agency, whether what you're doing is right. Some really horrific scenes of war and calling into question, like, you know, man's inhumanity to man. I realize the way that I'm describing this makes it sound very pat, but the game has a lot of nuance to it. So I worked on that very briefly. And that is a serious game that you come away from it being like, I don't feel so good, right? It's not a fun game in that regard. Mechanically, it's good, but it's not like I sit there and go, cool, what a blast, what a fun action thriller. It's kind of sad. But they jammed in a multiplayer mode into that too, using like the same characters and the same factions. And it was just very much that PS3, Xbox 360 era of add multiplayer. I could not care less whether it fits in the story or anything at all. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of the peak one of those to me. I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to go play multiplayer in this universe. This is a sad place.
Yeah, I do remember that Spec Ops game getting, I mean, The Line specifically, getting praise for its like narrative and everything like that all. But it blew me away because my experience was, it was the tail end, like one of the later gen releases. I think the PS2 technically may have already been released, but it was a $10 budget title. Like, it was advertised to be like, hey, get yourself a cheap game. Here's like a military shooter, Spec Ops. And I bought it thinking like, it's $10. Like, I'm sure I can have fun with this. And it was a little stiff and brutal and was not, you know, what I wanted it to be. But it was only $10. So, I like all good podcasts do, I'm actively looking at Wikipedia, you know, to learn more about this, what we're talking about. But the multiplayer mode of Spec Ops The Line was outsourced to Dark Side Game Studios, who had previously worked on the BioShock 2 multiplayer mode. So it's the same team which developed the multiplayer mode for BioShock 2 assisted him in creating it.
It's another 2K joint. That was very much the 2K promise at the day. And I should say, just to be very clear, I think mechanically the multiplayer was not bad. It was, so I'm not saying it's a bad thing or a bad multiplayer game. Same thing with the with BioShock 2. Actually, the multiplayer I remember actually being kind of fun. Does this need to be in the game? Does this serve the story? I don't know.
Well, I always thought it was neat. Like with those, like there was like a small community of people who would like rally around it and love like those multiplayer modes, and like, you know, people who loved it, like they loved it, you know, and but it just wasn't like this massively like flooded thing and all that stuff. So like it was neat that you could have so many different types of games, but it was just the awkward thing was that it was so shoehorned in, you know, that like, you know, it was brutal. Like, oh my gosh, there's gotta be multiplayer mode. So oftentimes I would just skip most of them, but I do remember trying to like, you know, take a stab at some and like, you know, kind of enjoying some of them. Like I did enjoy enjoy, like the Uncharted 3 multiplayer mode, you know, like there was just a progression to it that I thought like, oh, hey, this isn't just cookie cutter as much as it is 100% cookie cutter shoehorned multiplayer experience. But cool.
Yeah.
I have an example I'll share, and I kind of want to do this to cleanse myself. I had a bit of a moment today with some Nintendo 64 bashing, and I really still feel like I need to right some wrongs here. But I don't always answer the questions myself on the episode. It's typically the guest, but in this case, I think I should share one as well. We can have a discussion if you've played this game as well. But from a Nintendo 64 game that I loved, you know, you hear about Gears of War and they're like lock to cover based mechanics.
I know what you're going to say. I know it. I know it.
Yeah. Winbeck is a rad game that I think had all of the charm of, like the Sega, storytelling from like, you know, House of the Dead or things like that, like the cheesy vibes, but maybe they know it's cheesy, but maybe they don't, but like, that's okay. I'm still bought into this ridiculous like action story. I love the mechanics of it, navigating through and like taking cover to shoot and everything. And the over the top, like enemies and bosses you fought. And then that also had this, because it was a Nintendo 64 game, it also had a multiplayer mode. And, my friends, we would play that quite a bit. And, we still to this day, like in that game, you'd get shot and we'd always just be yelled, like, we'd be mad because you're using the blinking to your advantage. Like you'd run up and get like shot and you know you get shot, but you'd then just position yourself in a way that's going to retaliate and get a shot back against them with a stronger weapon. Right. And we were like abusing the mechanics of the game and everything. But I loved Winback. Yeah. So you've played it as well, then it sounds.
So this is my one of my so actually I have two crimes to confess to. One is that I've rented Winback and I've only played it a tiny bit. I don't have any good reason. I didn't even bounce off of it. It's just one of those games that I never, you know, it's just one of those games that like has always been on my radar. It always felt really neat because it never seemed like a Nintendo 64 game. It seemed like very much its own thing. But I never wound up actually playing it beyond that initial rental, which I remember enjoying it quite a bit. The other crime that I wanted to quickly, admit to is that I've also never played Chrono Trigger. You mentioned that earlier, but I've never played Chrono Trigger. So, so just got to mention that.
I'll share that. I have actually never played it myself either. My wife has played it. I watched her play through the original PS1 port of it. We had the DS version of it as well. And she actually, I got, that Polymega like set top like system and, put Chrono Trigger on there for her to play it, and she's gone through and she's almost finished it and all that stuff. She does not play games at all like hardcore like I do, but she loves herself some Chrono Trigger. So like I've seen it and like experienced it through her, you know, through a couple different generations and everything. So I know the power of Chrono Trigger. But yes, I will also admit proudly, not proudly, it's just one that's it's skipped and I'm okay. We're okay for not having played it. You know, there's other games we have played and it's okay that we didn't play that one masterpiece.
That's exactly right. Although I am kind of mad at myself for not ever having played Chrono Trigger because it's always right there as a thing I want to play and I've just never done it. So yes, I agree, except I must atone for Winback. I have to atone for not playing Winback.
My concern for like the Chrono Trigger thing though is if I do finally play it, like I'm unfortunately going to be judging it with like a modern lens, even trying to put myself in that mindset, which I can very much easily do, but like the minute like it takes too long to get in and out of a battle, I'm like, oh, there's some quality of life stuff they could really do to make this better. Like I can't put myself in the mid 90s brain to experience it for what it was. So I don't want to like ruin it by trying to play it now, but there's been long rumored like remakes. And if they did like one of those like great, like 2D HD style, like remakes of that, like that, I would play that. That'd be a day one buy for me. But, Winback was made by Omega Force as well, who we may know from such hit games as Dynasty Warriors and every single Dynasty Warriors title and spinoff and everything over the last two decades.
Okay. It was published by Koei, right? Was it Koei Tecmo? Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes some sense. Okay. Wow. That's a different type of video game than that. Interesting.
They did a couple of different things. They tried a few different things early on, and then they released Dynasty Warriors 2 and they were like, oh, cool, I think we found our thing. Like, let's go ahead and just like make sure we keep cashing these checks. And then that now turned into like, that is all that they are and will ever will be. There was like a PS1 fighting game I forget the name. It had like a funny sounding name that they also did. I remember, but like from there, like, yeah, I don't know any other thing that they've done besides that. But
once you get that cash cow, you roll with it.
Yeah. That game though, it was really cool. I just love the mechanics and the cover system and everything. And that was one of those ones that if my friends and I would pass the controller around, I would, I believe, need to invert my aim because I could not do it. But it was like a really weird moment because I my best friend and I and his little brother, who's basically my best friend as well, like we'd all grew up playing games together and everything. And that was just came out in a moment where it was like, I think the last big game we got to play together before I had to move away from where we lived there to a different state and everything. And so like, I kind of like lost a bit of my childhood and everything. And I was like, Win Back was kind of like this final game. So there's like this nostalgia tied up into it for me. And I remember like 2 years later or so, it may not even have been that long actually after. They ended up being a PS2 port of it that came out. It was like, you know, slightly better like character models and they slightly like up-resed it a little bit and all that stuff. But like when that came out, I was like, oh man, this is rad. I'm going to get this. And, you know, it's going to remind me of like my friends again. Like this is going to be great. And playing through that on PS2 was just a completely like out of left field, like re-release of this game that like I what other Nintendo 64 to PS2 conversions were there, you know? Like it was just such a strange thing to see, but I loved it. And
weird,
yeah, still friends with those friends to this day and everything. They're still, you know, we've figured out how to be friends as adults, you know, not necessarily living adjacently and everything, but yeah, those Win Back moments were great.
That's so cool. I will say with like something like Win Back, and I guess maybe expanding like pulling it out even further, just sort of the era of games where the different systems had their own very clear limitations. There's something about, and you know, I mean, this is just nostalgia. So I'm sure that this is true for kids, for the kids currently playing like Roblox in 20 years, they'll feel the same way. But I feel like there's something really special about those. So you say there's not a lot of N64 to PS2 kind of conversions. Those games felt really unique and specific to themselves, right? And they had their own textures. And that sort of thing, when I think back to that same era for me, like that really looms large as part of the nostalgia is, you know, like the hanging out with your friends, playing games that have clear limitations, working around those limitations or taking advantage of their systems in ways that they weren't supposed to because they weren't really necessarily fine-tuned all the way. I think that's something that I really cherish. I wouldn't say that I miss it because we can still go back to it. And I don't want to be one of those like people who wants to just return to the old days. But it is something that I really cherish about games like Win Back, just that texture.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, you say texture and you're talking about a Nintendo 64 game. I mean,
maybe I don't miss
very
textures.
Terrible textures, the lowest possible resolution textures, not like those beautiful crisp wobbly textures the PlayStation had, but it's neither here nor there. Well, we did the thing. So that's the episode. That's we answered the question. We came together and we did what we sought out to do. So I appreciate you for jumping on and having the conversation with me. Do you want to share any like links or sources people should like find you at, any social media plugs, anything you want to say before we wrap the episode?
Sure. I have detached myself from Twitter. That was a while ago, so that feels good. So I'm not there. I am on Blue Sky, which is exciting. We love Blue Sky, don't we, folks? It's just McConnell at McConnell.bsky.social is my thing. And the show, whatever it's called, the show that I host, which I'm blanking on the name of right now, Instruction Derby, thank you very much, is over at twitch.tv/NickMcConnell, NICMCCONNELL. And yeah, I do that Wednesdays at noon.
Moon Pacific, one mountain.
Moon Pacific.
Two
thank you very
Central,
much.
Three Eastern, if you wanted to.
That's right. That's
that.
Right. Give the entire thing. The end of the show can just be us reading off all the time zones for what time that is. Yes, noon Pacific. Thank you. That is an important distinction.
I jumped on one day to catch what I thought was going to be broadcasting and just mere minutes away. And then we're at a little group chat. And I was like, wait, if you're talking here, where's the show? Like, oh, I've got to sit here for another hour. I was already working. I was doing some writing and everything. So it didn't like bother me necessarily, but I was like, all right, starting. Oh no, I guess I've got another hour to kill. Darn that time zone.
I think I might be remembering that I may have forgotten the Pacific notice on there for that one. So that might have been my fault. But yeah, thanks for joining. Thanks for having me on here. I appreciate the heck out of it. This is a lot of fun. I love the format. I love the questions. It's nice always, too, to be able to highlight a game. And we were talking earlier, average games. I don't view this game as average. I don't view Gotham City Imposters as average. But apparently Metacritic does. 65 out of 100. So maybe it meets exactly the concept here. So to me, it's wonderful. And it has been... It hasn't been playable on consoles since like 2014, and was delisted on Steam in 2021. So there
it's
we
just
go.
Erased.
It's just gone. We got to get it back somehow. Let's do it.
All right. Well, thanks, Nick. We will definitely have you on a future episode for sure, and we may record that episode immediately following this episode. But not everyone knows that.
I'm ready.
All right. Thanks.